Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Alex Ritson, and at 13 hours GMT on Tuesday the 20th of June, these are our main stories. The US Coast Guard says it's expanding its search into deeper waters for a submersible that disappeared while taking wealthy tourists to the wreckage of the Titanic. French police have raided the headquarters of the committee organising next year's Paris Olympics. The social media influencer Andrew Tate has been charged in Romania with rape, human trafficking, and forming a criminal organisation to exploit women sexually. Also in this podcast, the authorities at Africa's largest national park in the Democratic Republic of Congo say recent violence by militia is endangering its future.
Because it's so rich in natural resources, it draws in all sorts of illegal trafficking interests. That's one of the reasons why armed militias are interested in the park and why they attack.
And we'll have a special report into a global monkey torture ring and the international efforts to dismantle it. The authorities are expanding their search into deeper waters for the submersible that disappeared while taking wealthy tourists to the wreckage of the Titanic off the coast of Canada. There's currently a race against time to find the tourist vessel. It was less than 2 hours after it started the dive on Sunday that it lost contact. It's believed the five crew members may have 60 hours worth of oxygen left as we record this podcast. Last year, the BBC filmed inside the Ocean Gate Titanic submersible. Stockton Rush, the chief executive of Ocean Gate, who features in this audio, is one of the people on board.
We run the sub with this game controller. It's made by Logitech, but it's basically a Sony PlayStation-style controller. If you want to go forward, you press forward. If you want to go back, you press back.
Our correspondent Jessica Parker is in Boston, from where the US and Canadian rescue attempt is being coordinated. She gave me the latest.
Gradually, a picture has emerged of the five people on the Titan submarine now. The first name we confirmed was that of Hamish Harding, a 58-year-old British billionaire businessman and explorer. Now we've heard that the businessman Shahzada Dawood and his son Suleiman as well are among those on board. Also a French explorer, and Stockton Rush is believed to be on board, widely reported to be on board. He's the chief executive of Ocean Gate, which runs these expeditions. So those appear to be the five people on the vessel, for which now, of course, this huge search is being carried out and coordinated from here in Boston.
And how is that rescue operation going? Because as rescue operations go, this is about as difficult as it gets, isn't it?
It's extremely difficult. I mean, first of all, it's 900 miles off the coast of where I am. It's a little closer to the coast of Newfoundland, but it's in a very remote area, so that presents massive challenges. We've been trying to contact the Coast Guard this morning. It's just after 8 a.m. here, US time, and we haven't had any updates, but we know there are kind of two main elements to the search. One is the use of aircraft to just scour the surface of the ocean, look for any signs that the vessel might have actually managed to get itself back up to the surface after contact was lost during its dive on Sunday. And then also they are dropping sonar buoys onto the water to detect activity underneath. And what the Coast Guard is saying is that they can actually listen to a depth of 13,000 feet. Now, that is deep enough to actually reach the seabed where the Titanic wreckage lies. But then the big question is, if the vessel is deep underwater, how would they actually carry out some kind of rescue? Many believe this will be extremely difficult.
Jessica Parker in Boston. The trip down to see the wreckage of the Titanic that began on Sunday morning off the Canadian coast should have been over by the end of the day. It's a journey Mike Rees did last year. He's been telling my colleague Michelle Hussein about it.
It's very interesting in that it almost was without incident until the last 10 seconds of the trip. That is to say, going down, exploring the ocean bottom, coming up was all fine. And then when we were lifted by crane back onto the ship that carried the submarine, the sub suddenly went vertical and we all plunged to the bottom of the submarine and everything came flying on top of us, our lunch and computers and everything. That was the only danger in the entire 8-hour trip. But the experience going down was very relaxing. It's a beautifully designed submarine that feels almost spa-like on the inside. So even though there's five people just sitting on the floor of something that's about the size of a minivan, it's very comfortable and it's very relaxing. And I fell asleep on the way down. It's just 2.5 hours of dropping in utter quiet. And there is a porthole, but all you see is blackness going down. And then when we touched bottom, we knew we were within 500 meters of the Titanic, but we didn't know in what direction. And we spent a good 90 minutes just sort of doing a random walk on the bottom of the ocean, just flailing around, trying to find, you know, the biggest boat in the world is somewhere near us, but we couldn't see it in the darkness. And
but you did then catch sight of it.
That was it. With 20 minutes left, 20 minutes before we had to resurface, we finally saw the Titanic. And I have to say, it was just enough in our case for a highlights tour. We just got there, looked at the anchor, looked at the porthole, looked at the bow of the ship, and then we had to go back up. And it shows you the unpredictability of it all, in that the next day they sent another five passengers down to see it, and they had a good 3 hours to explore the Titanic, and they circled it and got to see every inch of it.
Mike, were you not afraid at all doing this journey? I mean, this description you have of being relaxing on the way down, you're doing something that is full of risk.
Yes, and somehow there's just this acceptance of it. Nobody walked into this with any illusions that, you know, this was a lark or this was a roller coaster. You sign a waiver before you even get on the boat, and it mentions death and three different ways you can die on page one. And this is why I have this sympathy for the people on board the ship that they're not panicking, that they knew what they were getting into. And that was my feeling. There was just a sense of calm. But, you know, I got on the sub and at the back of my mind was, well, I may never get off of this thing. You know, that's always with you.
You must be looking back at the experience in quite a different way, knowing what's happening right now.
Yes, I just feel for these people very much. I you know, my hopes are with them. I'm not optimistic in that. I know how tiny the vessel is and how huge the ocean is, and sort of how remarkable the sub is, that, you know, they built this beautiful submarine that can go where no other vessel can go. So if you know, in the worst case, they are down at the bottom of the ocean, I can't see how anyone will be able to get to them, much less rescue them.
Mike Rees. With just over a year to go until the Paris Olympics, organisers have confirmed that their offices have been raided by French police. They're also raiding the offices of the public body in charge of construction projects for the Games. Officials say the raid is linked to alleged favouritism and embezzlement of public funds, as our Paris correspondent Hugh Schofield reports.
Anti-corruption investigators arrived unannounced at the headquarters of the Olympics Organising Committee in Saint-Denis in the northern Paris suburbs, as well as at the offices of the public body Solideo, which is in charge of building projects for the Games, including the athletes and media villages. The Organising Committee said it was cooperating fully with the police, who are looking into allegations of favouritism and misuse of public money in the attribution of certain construction and consulting contracts. The Paris Games begin in July next year, and major works are underway to build amenities and infrastructure, which will afterwards revert to the city.
Hugh Schofield. The social media influencer Andrew Tate has been charged in Romania with rape, human trafficking and forming an organised crime group to sexually exploit women. The 36-year-old former professional kickboxer is best known for promoting his misogynistic views and what he describes as ultra-masculine online courses. Our correspondent Lucy Williamson is in Bucharest. She has previously interviewed him and she told me more about the latest developments.
There are four defendants named in this indictment: Andrew Tate, his brother Tristan, and two associates, two Romanian women who worked with them and were closely associated with them. In the indictment, there are seven alleged victims, and the police here are saying that these victims were forced to make pornographic material after being recruited by the Tate brothers with false promises of love and marriage. There's also an additional charge of rape against one of the defendants and a general charge of creating this organised crime group in order to exploit the victims. It's quite wide-ranging, I should say, this indictment. There are additional charges that have been added in, violence against one of the alleged victims. And we're told that the human trafficking allegations, that they didn't happen just in Romania, but also in other countries like the US and the UK.
And he has denied this, hasn't he? How important a figure, though, is he as an online influencer?
Yes, they have denied the charges. In fact, a spokeswoman for the Tates today came out and said that they embraced this opportunity to demonstrate their influence. It's obviously been quite a long investigation, and she says that they welcome this chance to set forward their case and prove their innocence. I think in terms of his profile, yeah, I mean, I think he has garnered a really big following online for his statements, not just about his statements about masculinity and how to be successful, how to make money, but also his views on relationships with women and how men should treat women. And this case in Romania has really put a very strong spotlight on that around the world.
Any sign of whether this legal process briefly is affecting his online popularity?
Well, he spent several months in custody and several months under house arrest, and it doesn't seem to have dented his appeal. He's been very active on social media since being released into house arrest. We're told that that house arrest will continue for the moment until a court rules on what to do. But no, so far it seems his popularity is continuing.
Lucy Williamson in Bucharest. Donald Trump has given his first interview since appearing in a federal court in Florida last week, charged under the Espionage Act. The former president pleaded not guilty to 37 charges, including keeping classified and top-secret documents in unsecured areas of his Mar-a-Lago resort. This is what he told Brett Baier on Fox News about having such documents in his possession.
I had boxes. I want to go through the boxes and get all my personal things out. I don't want to hand that over to NARA yet. And I was very busy, as you've sort of seen.
Yeah, but according to the indictment, you then tell this aide to move to other locations after telling your lawyers to say you'd fully complied with the subpoena when you hadn't.
But before I send boxes over, I have to take all of my things out. These boxes were interspersed with all sorts of things.
Our North America editor, Sarah Smith, listened to the interview.
He actually had a different excuse this time. We've had many, many different versions from Donald Trump as to what he was doing with these documents. It's not a brilliant excuse, given that, you know, he'd had 18 months. He'd had his lawyers sign affidavits saying that a diligent search had been completed and that no more sensitive or classified papers were contained within these boxes. But, you know, it's an interesting new spin. Normally, defendants in cases like this would go out of their way to avoid saying anything in public at all, just in case it was used against them in court, but Donald Trump doesn't seem to be remotely worried about that. He went on to say, as he has before, that he had declassified all of these documents when he was president, even though there's no evidence of that, and that he's done nothing wrong at all, casting up again and again that both Joe Biden and Mike Pence had found classified documents among their papers that they had taken from the White House after both of them had finished being vice president, and claiming that they had more documents than he did and that they were the ones who were in the wrong, whereas he's completely innocent.
And now that he's been arraigned and the criminal proceedings are underway, Sarah, are there restrictions on where he can go? I mean, clearly not restrictions on who he can talk to, but what are the kinds of arrangements and how far into the future will this trial be?
So we don't know how long it's going to be before the trial begins. And normally it would be about a year, but this one is complicated by the fact that Trump's lawyers need to get classifications that would allow them to look at these documents. They need to get security clearances. And there are other reasons why it will probably take longer. It could be the other side of the 2024 presidential election before the case gets going. And it's, we think that's probably what Donald Trump would prefer, and therefore he may use all kinds of legal devices to try and delay the trial from happening. In the meantime, there's no restrictions on his movements at all. He's not allowed to discuss the case or the documents with anybody who is likely to be a witness in this trial. But as yet, the judge hasn't told him not to talk about it in public. He has been told not to make any of the evidence in the case public. He's not to publish or release any of the documents at issue. But he hasn't been told that he can't give interviews user speeches, complaining, as he does, that this is a political case that's been brought against him because Joe Biden is trying to target his main political opponent and weaponize the justice system.
Sarah Smith, and we've just heard that the federal judge Aileen Cannon has set an initial trial date of August the 14th for former President Donald Trump's Florida documents case. An upsurge in violence in the Democratic Republic of Congo is endangering the future of wildlife in the Virunga National Park, according to the park authorities. The area is the largest national park in Africa and is a World Heritage Site. It's a crucial hub for nature and biodiversity, as well as one of the few homes of the endangered mountain gorilla population. The director of the Virunga National Park, Emmanuel Dimarode, has been telling my colleague Victoria Uwankunda that violence caused by rebel militias is putting the park in jeopardy.
The situation for our staff in Virunga National Park has become incredibly difficult. We're a national park that's situated in eastern Congo, where a situation of armed conflict has developed over the last few months, and it's grown very significantly in the past few weeks. Our staff have come under attack. Seven of our team members have been killed, many more wounded, which adds to a situation in which we've become extremely vulnerable in the efforts to protect Virunga, which is an extraordinarily important national park.
What is it like then for the rest of you working in such conditions?
So over the past 6 months, all of the national park has been overrun by what we refer to as armed groups, armed militias, many of whom are fighting the national government. We as a National Park Service are part of the government, and there are many areas where we're very much alone in the effort to uphold the rule of law and keep the national park safe.
What are you seeing since you've had this increased threat to your work and to the lives of the people who work in the park?
Well, the reason we continue the work is really for two reasons. One is that the national park is perhaps one of the greatest national parks on earth. It has the highest level of biodiversity for any national park on earth. It has three taxa of great apes. And of course, because of all that, it's a World Heritage Site. That means that it's necessary to keep it alive. It's incredibly important for the biodiversity of the planet, but also for the future economy of the region in terms of tourism development. But in part because it's so rich in natural resources, it draws in all sorts of illegal trafficking interests. That's one of the reasons why armed militias are interested in the park and why they attack park staff. And there are over a dozen different militias that exist in the region. The park for the last 10 years has been working with the community on promoting development initiatives, because that's the only long-term solution to building stability around the region, generating new forms of energy and industry around the park, and about 12,000 jobs have been created by the park over the past 10 years.
And it is those armed conflicts that have been ongoing for almost three decades, especially in the east of the Democratic Republic of Congo, the region of North and South Kivu. And recently, just last week, we've just seen this heinous attack on a school in Uganda by the Allied Democratic Forces, whom are now suspected to have been behind that attack, but also now reportedly gone back into the Virunga National Park or in those vicinities and the areas. Does it worry you that you've got such groups in the neighborhood, in nearby areas, near the apes that you mentioned and the gorillas and the work that you're trying to do?
An important thing to say is that, you know, whilst that did capture the world's attention because of the awful nature of it, it's almost a daily occurrence in Congo, and that doesn't capture world attention in the same way. But young children, innocent members of the community are killed every day in that way, as are members of our team, people who work to protect Virunga National Park.
The director of the Virunga National Park, Emmanuel de Merode. Still to come in this podcast, a possible sighting of one of Australia's most famous whales, a white humpback, who had been believed to be dead.
There is something magnificent about seeing this white, illuminating animal underwater. And around the world, there's only a handful of white whales, and people are fascinated by them because they look different.
Every weekday morning, wake up with an in-depth look at a single story that's affecting Africa right now.
And every weekday afternoon, wind down with three essential stories from across the continent and hear African perspectives on global news.
That's what you'll get from Africa Daily.
And Focus on Africa.
Two BBC World Service podcasts all about Africa.
And where will they find them, Alan?
Just search for Africa Daily and Focus on Africa wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
A BBC investigation has revealed a global monkey torture ring. The group began on YouTube before moving into private Telegram groups where Westerners were commissioning videos of baby monkeys being abused and killed from people in Indonesia. An international law enforcement effort is now underway to dismantle a network spanning three continents. Rebecca Henschke reports, and a warning, you may find the content of this report distressing.
This is baby monkey Minnie, just days old and very vulnerable. She was taken from her mother in the forest and sold to a YouTuber who abused her and filmed it.
This Minnie, bro, you know, artist in YouTube, but we can torture her in here.
There were loads of videos of Minnie being both physically and psychologically tortured. And she was just one among thousands of monkeys being abused. Under the videos of her on YouTube was a handle with a note that said, "For more extreme content, contact me." Our undercover reporter, I'm calling Steve, did that, and after weeks of chatting, got Minnie's torturer on the phone.
Bro, how long have you tortured monkey for?
1 year, 60 months, maybe. My contact in Telegram, about 1,000 more.
Wow.
It is like a torture. Yes, of course. Bro. Yeah, this is my job. And I like this.
We spent months undercover and tracked down one of the ringleaders in Florida. He's agreed to an interview as long as we don't use his real name. He found the videos on YouTube and then contacted Minnie's torturer.
I reached out to him because the content that I was getting on YouTube wasn't extreme enough for me. It's kind of hard to talk about, but I was looking to see another being in distress. At the time, I was going through a very difficult portion of my, you know, college experience, and just in life, things were very bad for me. And it was almost a relief in a way to see something else being tortured. I felt like I was kind of being tortured in my life, and it was relieving to see just an animal being mistreated. It is deeply wrong, but it was something out of my control.
He's now under investigation by the Department for Homeland Security. In 2019, President Trump signed into law a bill that makes acts of online animal cruelty a federal crime punishable with fines and up to 7 years in prison. In Indonesia, we tipped off the police who arrested Minnie's torturer, Ajis Rasajana. And 4 months later, I visit Minnie at an animal sanctuary run by the Jakarta Animal Aid Network.
Hey, Minnie. Oh, my God. She's so different.
And there's a chance that she could be released back in the wild in just 2 years' time.
Hey.
The criminal cases in the US and the UK against people involved in the abuse of Minnie and other baby monkeys are ongoing. There are still active monkey abuse groups on social media.
Rebecca Henschke, and you can find a full online version of her piece on our website, bbcnews.com. A Sikh man wanted by the Indian government for alleged terrorism offences has been killed by two gunmen in the car park of a temple in Canada. Hardeep Singh Nija was the leader of a Sikh temple in British Columbia. He advocated for a separate Sikh state in India. Our South Asia editor Anbarasan Etarajan told us more.
According to Canadian police, Hardeep Singh Nijjar, he was found with gunshot wounds in the car park of this temple, the Sikh temple called Gurudwara, a couple of days ago, and he was found dead. And some of his supporters, they think that there could be a foul play because they say that the Canadian intelligence warned him of threats to his life a few months ago. And on the other hand, the Indian authorities accuse him of terror charges and also a conspiracy to murder people, which he had denied during interviews to various newspapers in Canada. But this has again caused a shockwave among the Sikh community in Canada, where there's a sizable number of people live, nearly 800,000. They also play a crucial role in social, economic and also in politics in Canada. And the presence of Sikh diaspora is a very, very key thing for Canada itself because it is inviting various people from across the world to settle down. But on the other hand, a tiny section, a minority of this group, they are now supporting for their separate homeland for Sikhs in India's Punjab state. And that has, you know, caused a bitter relationship between Canada and India in recent years.
And there is speculation that India could be behind this. This man did have a bounty on his head.
There are allegations that it could be the handiwork of some foreign agencies or people inside Canada, but there is no evidence at this point to suggest. Police are looking into various angles, but all we know is that he was shot dead and he was wanted in India. But you have to look at the broader picture of the Sikh diaspora in countries like Canada, in UK and in the USA, because they are still feeling very aggrieved about what happened to the community in the 80s and 90s in India when there was an insurgency going on for a separate Sikh state, when thousands of people were killed during these insurgency operations. They were disappeared and they feel that none of these cases were properly investigated. Even though peace has returned to Punjab state, people feel that the scars still remain.
Anbarasan Etarajan. Visitors to Rome can now get close to the spot where it's thought Julius Caesar was murdered more than 2,000 years ago. The Lago di Torre Argentina, a square filled with ruined temples, was excavated in the 1920s and opened to the public this morning. Danny Eberhardt takes up the story.
The square's temples were excavated in the 1920s. For decades, tourists have had to look down at the ruins from street level. Now they can pay to use new walkways to stroll among them, learning about the site's storied past. The square's famous for its sunbathing felines. A shelter for stray and abandoned cats is staying put. It also has part of the base of a building that once held sessions of ancient Rome's Senate. Here on the Ides of March in 44 BC, Julius Caesar was stabbed to death by a group of senators. Expect plenty of off-the-cuff reenactments of Et tu, Brute? The Shakespearean line that Caesar himself probably never said.
Danny Eberhardt. Australia's annual whale migration has begun, with researchers documenting an unusually high number of humpback whales. Scientists say the surge is a sign that whale populations are recovering. The whales migrate north from the Antarctic to breed and calve in the warmer waters. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
It's one of nature's epic migrations. Thousands of whales are on their annual journey up eastern and western Australia to breeding grounds in the north. They can often be seen and heard from the shoreline. One regular visitor has become a celebrity. Migaloo is a rare white whale that was first spotted in 1991. The albino humpback has his own Twitter account and was thought to have died. But last week, a tourist flying over the Great Barrier Reef in Queensland filmed what appeared to be a white humpback swimming north. Researchers can't be sure if Australia's most famous whale has returned. Vanessa Perotta from Macquarie University says he's a legend.
I've seen Migaloo. He's like an iceberg underwater. There is something magnificent about seeing this white, illuminating animal underwater. And around the world, there's only a handful of white whales, and people are fascinated by them because they look different.
Humpbacks and southern right whales were among several species that were once slaughtered for their oil, blubber and bones. Hunting was banned in Australia in 1978. Humpback numbers along the east coast have returned close to pre-whaling levels. But wildlife campaigners remain concerned about some southern right populations. All whales in Australia are protected under national environment laws as they recover from decades of exploitation.
Phil Mercer. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on Twitter @globalnewspod. This edition was produced by Alice Adderley and was mixed by Dan Ehrlich. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Alex Ritson. Until next time, goodbye.
Hello, Nairobi. I said, hello, Nairobi.
Hi, I'm Namulanta Kombo, and my BBC World Service podcast, Dear Daughter, is on the road, here in my hometown of Nairobi in Kenya. It's the podcast where we share letters and stories and words of wisdom for daughters everywhere. And this is the second of two Dear Daughter live shows, the Relationship Special. So, you know what to do. Wherever you find your BBC podcast, search for Let's Do It Everyone. Search for 1, 2, 3.
Dear Daughter!